This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. This program is proudly sponsored by Smart Power and Nuclear Waste Antidote, energy drinks that combine the technology of smart drugs with the properties of energy drinks. Learn why the Smart Power formula feels so much better at SmartEnergyEnterprises.com.
I think that dialogues with Duncan Campbell are much more than ordinary interviews. They're genuine conversations that have real substance and depth and very interesting explorations of ideas.
Throughout history, from indigenous councils to the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a dialogos, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now as together we engage in living dialogue. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have my friend and author, Andrew Weil, MD, as my guest. Andrew Weil is known to you as the author of 10 previous books, including Spontaneous Healing, 8 Weeks to Optimum Health, Eating Well for Optimum Health, and with Rosie Daly, The Healthy Kitchen. A graduate of Harvard Medical School, he is clinical professor of medicine and director of the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona. He writes Self-Healing, a monthly newsletter, and maintains the website drweil.com. More of his work on aging can be found at www.healthyaging.com. He lives in southern Arizona and is the author most recently of Healthy Aging, a lifelong guide to your physical and spiritual well-being. So, Andy, what a pleasure to have you back on Living Dialogues.
It's been a while.
It's been, 10 years since you first came on the scene, as it were, with your book Spontaneous Healing. At that point, we were doing Living Dialogues on television, and I remember it well. And here we are, both about a year apart. You're 62, I'm 61 as we record this. And I wanted to begin this particular dialogue on the topic of your most recent book with what has happened to you in that decade between being in your early 50s when Spontaneous Healing first came out and now in your early 60s on the threshold, as you put it, of becoming an elder. Tell us a story from that decade that is transformative in some way and led to this book.
First of all, I thought that turning 50 was going to be the big milestone.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't, in retrospect. I think things were pretty much as usual, although it's been a very busy, active decade for me. But I think when I turned 60, it was impossible to ignore the fact that I had entered a different phase of life. I had a lot of friends and colleagues who were asking me to put down on paper as quickly as I could my thoughts about healthy aging. And I have been very bothered in this past period by the rise of anti-aging medicine and by the dominance of anti-aging messages in our culture. I think we're just bombarded from all directions by voices telling us that the goal is to turn back the clock, to stop the clock, to grow younger.
It's very interesting you say that because in the intervening decades since we first did our program, I have spoken out many, many times about a vision that came to me that planetary consciousness is evolving now into the threshold of real maturity, that if we look back on the evolution of the species, one way of seeing it is similar to that of the evolution of a person, that we begin in the matrix of the womb, we began in the ocean, we came across the tide pools, ultimately we became Homo sapiens and then Homo sapiens sapiens. So in a way, I see the indigenous cultures of the planet that go back, you know, to the very beginnings of human time as representing a kind of matrix childhood phase of the species where they were embedded in Mother Nature. They were on good terms with nature. They understood nature to be an alive, living universe. They made it an ally wherever they could. And yet, at a certain point, the need of the human to empower itself over and against nature, like an adolescent leaving home and leaving childhood, began to set in. Some people date it to the first cave paintings, other people to agriculture and domestication of animals. And most recently, the modern mind, for the last 500 years, inventing things in opposition to nature. We have Francis Bacon in the 16th century saying, "We will put nature on the rack and torture her secrets from her for the benefit of man's estate." And eventually that attitude leading to the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, the Internet, nuclear weapons, international air travel, and all the rest that is now making us one planet, like Bucky Fuller said, Spaceship Earth. But the people at the controls are still in an adolescent mindset, and our culture is still preoccupied with immortality and self-realization of power, a kind of hubris that is really endangering all of us. So a voice like yours now speaking out to say, let's look for the wise elder, let's look for the wisdom that's in ourselves, and not give in to this anti-aging movement, I think is just one of the great signs of our times of moving forward into a deeply mature consciousness that can really enable the species itself, we might say, to survive.
Setting a goal of anti-aging is taking a position completely contrary to nature. Aging is a natural universal process. Everything in the universe ages. Being a botanist first and a physician second has given me a unique perspective on medicine and health. And one of the major themes of my work has been to try to reconnect medicine with nature and to point out to people the wisdom of living in harmony with nature. And part of that would mean accepting the aging process. You talked about maturity. Certainly that is one of the positive aspects of aging. Aging brings maturity or ripening of a human life. But living as we do in a youth-obsessed culture, we view aging, or most people in our culture view aging, as a catastrophe. And we look only at its negatives. And I think that's what leaves us so vulnerable to the anti-aging messages that are coming at us from so many directions.
And in a sense, it really is part of the adolescent phase, I think, of consciousness. And we're clinging on to it in a certain way. And it does share with adolescents sometimes that sense of timeless immortality. Mm-hmm. You say in your book, I think quite wonderfully, that the aging process and facing death actually is a key to opening up new understandings, new worldviews, a new sense of wisdom. And I've heard Rabbi Zalman Schachter, for instance, founder of the Spiritual Eldering Institute, say quite wisely, getting older doesn't mean getting wiser. It's only if you face your own mortality. Mm-hmm. And he likes to use the computer image of downloading all the inessentials from your drive and cleaning it up so that you actually have something of real value to impart to the world and share.
The first chapter of my book is called Immortality, and it looks at that concept. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it from various points of view and tried to point out the problems with it. At the cellular level, immortality equates with cancerous growth. When cells turn malignant, they become immortal. And this, by the way, should be cautionary about tinkering with the genetic controls of aging, because by doing so, we may expose ourselves to a much greater risk of cancer. I think many writers and philosophers have agreed that immortality would be unbearable, and that it is death and awareness of mortality that gives life meaning. And for that reason, I also worry about the amount of energy that's invested in our culture in procedures, cosmetic surgery, Botox, designed to mask the outward appearance of aging, because I think that this makes it harder to come to terms with the fact that aging is occurring, to look at its significance, to face mortality.
Well, you talk beautifully at the end of that first chapter about the Greek myth of immortality, and you quote Alfred Lord Tennyson in his poem to that effect, that contains the memorable line, "After many a summer dies the swan." We've all heard that, but we haven't necessarily, all of us, heard the rest of it.
Yeah.
And it says, and I'll quote and ask you to comment, the woods decay and fall. The vapors weep their burden to the ground. Man comes and tills the field and lies beneath. And after many a summer dies the swan. Me only cruel immortality consumes. I wither slowly in thine arms. And that me is...
Tithonus, a minor character in a Greek myth, whose lover, Eos, the goddess of dawn, got Zeus to grant immortality for Tithonus, but forgot to ask that he stay young as well and healthy, and so he aged relentlessly, becoming a withered, suffering creature, and she eventually shut him away. So this is, you know, I talk about the Tithonian disaster, which is something that we're already capable of in modern medicine, that is preserving life without preserving health. And I think it's, you know, it cautions us about being careful what we wish for. You know, how much extended life would you like to have if the quality of life is not good?
Well, this is really leading us right into one of the next points you make, is the difference between longevity and senescence.
Senescence is decline. It is, at the cellular level, senescence is the cessation of the ability to reproduce and divide. And although senescent cells, for a while, carry on normal metabolism, eventually they go into a downward curve and die. In human life, senescence is the period in which age-related disease begins to occur. The big categories of age-related disease are cardiovascular disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's and related neurodegenerative diseases. Now, I don't think that that age-related disease is synonymous with the aging process. And the point of my book, Healthy Aging, is about how to live long and well and then have a rapid drop-off at the end. So it's not about anti-aging. It's not about reversing the aging process. It's about delaying the onset and reducing the risk of age-related disease. That seems to me is a legitimate goal. And I worry that anti-aging is a great distraction from that goal.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I'm thinking now, a decade ago when we first did our dialogue on your book, Spontaneous Healing, you said at that time, I'm a great fan of the healthcare crisis because it's going to force us ultimately to a whole different and better way of doing medicine and of being a patient. We spoke at that time of the huge amounts of money that are spent in end-of-life care with these very expensive machines and equipment, keeping people alive even as the forces of nature within them are wanting to actually move to the next stage. And you said this will finally make us face up to the realities that we need to confront to live a more joyful life of spontaneous healing while we are alive. Here we are a decade later, not much progress, it seems, on the external scene.
Well, I think the progress toward the collapse of the healthcare system is going just fine, and I think we will all see that shortly. In the past 10 years, I have mostly focused on developing this field of integrative medicine, and it is alive and well. Our program at the University of Arizona, now in its 10th year, has graduated over 300 physicians and some nurse practitioners, and these people are practicing all over the country and working in other academic medical institutions. 30 medical schools in the U.S. and Canada are now part of a consortium for integrative medicine. So this is happening. And I think, you know, clearly this is the kind of medicine that people want. Institutions are slowly responding. And what I think is really going to make this a mainstream movement is the economic crisis that you referred to. Because as the healthcare system collapses, I think that any system which can lower costs by bringing lower cost treatments into the mainstream is going to become very important. So I think in the next decade we are going to see rapid evolution in this direction.
And we may see rapid devolution of the healthcare system.
Well, they go together. You know, I think it's only out of the ashes of that, of the present system, will we see the creation of new models, new healthcare institutions, and new ways of doing it.
And that was my point. Yeah, exactly. That there is this great paradox, we might call it, you know, the Shiva paradox, that it's only in destruction that the way can be made for the creation of new life. And in the destruction and the decay and the falling apart of the body, a transition can happen even while we're still alive, a transition of consciousness. And as you put it, I think, quite well in your book, the we might say, the degeneration of the body can lead to a spiritual awakening and rejuvenation of the spirit in preparation for what we might call a graceful passage into the next mode of consciousness, which is called death. But it doesn't mean necessarily that everything ends at that point. And we don't have to necessarily even believe there's life after death to understand that a graceful passage is more desirable than one where you're being kept alive in a semi-comatose way with very expensive machines. And what I meant earlier, that there hasn't been much progress on the external level, is that at the political and social level, we still have the Terry Schiavo case. We have Governor Dick Lamb of Colorado being dismissed as Governor Doom when he tried to actually talk about the economics of healthcare and how we were sacrificing the wellness of people who are alive to keep people alive at the end beyond the natural time when a graceful passage would be possible.
Right. Well, this is the Tythonian outcome.
Exactly.
That myth points to.
Yeah.
I have a chapter in the book called The Value of Aging that I had a lot of fun writing. I asked people to look at areas of their experience where aging clearly increases worth. The examples I used were whiskey, wine, cheese, trees, violins, antiques, and to think about what qualities time brings out in them that makes us willing to pay more money for old versions than for young versions. One theme that I wrote about was that the very processes of decay that ultimately lead to senescence, decline, death, along the way produce maturity and greatness. So in other words, with as you look at the ripening of cheese, for example, this is a form of controlled decay, and yet it produces something magnificent along the way. So I think that there are some interesting lessons to learn from those natural processes, that you can't separate the processes of decay and senescence from things that also lead to greatness and enlightenment.
And that's one of the things I most enjoy about your books, Andy, is the scope and breadth of your curiosity, which is also a sign of someone that's aging well, I might add, that you bring your skills as a scientist, as a botanist, and your medical training and your natural curiosity all to bear when you talk about whiskey or when you talk about wine. You talk about it in a very precise way where, for the first time, a lover of wine, realized in your writing a level of technical detail of how it actually comes from the grape and appears in your glass. That was really a source of great interest and pleasure, and particularly when you talked about the Chateau d'Yquem, the very famous dessert wine, which I have also, like you, had the privilege of having on rare occasion. It's very expensive because it has what you call, in the French, called pourriture noble, or
noble rot.
Exactly.
Right.
And that, I think, captured it in a wonderful way. The way you tell these kinds of stories, it makes your point graphically in an imagistic way so that people can say, well, yes, this isn't just an idea. You know, there is an actuality here that a rot or a decay could be noble because it could lead to a intensification of the depth and the
concentration of the most worthwhile aspect of something.
And we call that character.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So I think it's clear that there are analogies in human life, that aging can bring richness of character, wisdom, greater equanimity, greater creativity. In other cultures, older people are valued for those qualities. I think that's hard to see in this culture where we see aging wholly as a catastrophe, look only at its negatives, and extol youth. So I would love to see all this change in our culture. It's a big one to take on, but I'm determined to try to get it to move.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I'm just thinking of this funny story of, you know, an adolescent trying to individuate and be very different than the norm, you know, looking upon the adult world as really already decayed, already passé, not interested in it, and actually wanting to make a statement of youth. And in this case, they had spiked hair of many different colors and was sitting on a park bench near an old man. And the old man was looking at him rather intently. And so the young guy looked at him and said, "What is it, old man? Got nothing better to do? Haven't you ever done anything interesting in your life?" And the old man said, "Well, you know, I once made love to a parrot, and I thought you might be my son. So that's that kind of edgy quality, you know, somehow between youth and elders, where in a culture that doesn't respect elders, there is this unfortunate barrier where they have so much in common, because the adolescent actually and the elder are both on the margins of society, and they have the potential for a natural kind of alliance. Uh-huh. And that, I think, is something that you're really opening up that possibility in your book, because if the people in the middle, the people that hold the conventional middle-aged wisdom, begin to respect the elders, they can pass that down to their own children, and their own children know there's something funny when mom is into Botox and facelifts at 50 and wearing mini skirts that doesn't quite feel right. If you're the 18-year-old daughter, mom, you know, really, be more dignified. You know, like, you're beautiful the way you are. It feels funny to them, and it sends them a confusing message as well.
Now, we're at a very interesting point in our history, because never before have human populations had such high percentages of old people in them. The baby boomers are going to start turning 60 next year. They've been a very influential segment of this population, and I don't think they're going to settle for the models of aging that previous generations have bought into. So I think this is a good time to start this dialogue and to start people thinking about the negative conceptions about aging that now dominate our culture, and how we might try to change them.
Well, two things come to my mind as you're saying that. I think there's tremendous possibilities here with the baby boomers. You and I are just 1 or 2 years ahead of the formal 1946 starting date. So we're kind of right.
We're war babies.
Yeah, we're war babies, and we're right on the edge. We're on a cusp of the wave just as it began. And so I always feel that I've had a foot in both generations. Mm-hmm. I feel comfortable with baby boomer mentality, but I also feel just enough different that I feel a certain perspective on it. And one of the things that comes to my mind is this book, America the Wise, which the author talks about the potential for the baby boomers, with advances in modern medicine, with their becoming more aware of healthy nutrition, thanks to books like yours from a decade ago, Spontaneous Healing, with your 8-week program to optimal health. And that they will have more energy and more of a sense of possibility, and they could actually become a new elder generation to replace the greatest generation, you know, that Tom Brokaw has written about. And we've had this interregnum here where we've had a big gap, which people sometimes refer to as postmodernism. My friend Richard Tarnas, the author of the great book, The Passion of the Western Mind, calls postmodernism an era between eras, where the modern mind, with its individuating, self-referential, technological, achievement-based sense of identity, is no longer making it, because it can't continue to control the world. We have war and conflict everywhere, no confidence really at a deep level in our political leaders, and so we do need a shift in consciousness, and that's what I meant by the maturity earlier. For instance, on the environment alone, to take one example, one wag said that the attitude of our present governing forces around the world, in the industrial world, toward the environment is the same as a teenager toward the refrigerator. You know, that we just consume without a plug-in to the biofeedback of nature and where that replenishment and potential abundance comes from. And we're actually wasting our resources, quite literally, in all senses of the word, because that adolescent consciousness has not yet matured. And I think part of the maturity is going back to what Martin Prechtel called the indigenosity of our human soul, which is in all of us, and calling forth that indigenous elder wisdom that's there, that understands that we must be with the flow of nature and not trying to control it if we're going to move to the next more mature level and endure in a healthy, happy, peaceful way as a species.
Well, as I say, this has been a major theme of my writing.
Absolutely.
And I deplore the fact that in my own profession in medicine, especially in the 20th century, that so many people in that field have tried to, or their work has intensified fear of nature, and taken us away from it. You know, I've always seen nature as the source of healing, and I think there are many lessons to be learned from nature, but you're only going to get those if you live close to it and observe it and try to learn from it rather than trying to control it.
And that's where I think your background as a botanist and your extraordinary experience in some of your prior books before Spontaneous Healing, like From Chocolate to Morphine, for instance, where you looked at naturally occurring substances and herbs and saw what effects they could have on the mind-body, both very positive and in rare cases, yeah, deleterious. And here in your ethical will, which we'll come to in a minute, you say, I believe it is important to live in harmony with nature. Many people I meet are fearful of nature, regarding it as fundamentally hostile. I am sorry to say I encounter this attitude a lot in my own profession. Many of my medical colleagues really believe that pharmaceutical drugs are safer than herbal remedies, for example, because the drugs are known, at least to us, and pure. In my experience, it's just the other way around. The percentage of plants or mushrooms or insects that can kill or seriously hurt you is very tiny. The percentage of pharmaceutical drugs that can kill or seriously hurt you is not tiny. And two brief observations on that. One is there's a medical term, and you know it, for people that die because of improperly prescribed drugs, and they're, I think, a plane load per day. It's like, what is it, 360,000 a year
it's
or something
lot,
like that?
A lot, hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands that die because these drugs are so powerful. If they're prescribed in the wrong combination or for the right wrong person, they can result in death. And the second observation has to do with walking in the Amazon jungle, as I did back in 1992 after the Earth Summit. And a man with a machete, our guide, was just stopping at each tree, you know, hacking off something and say, this is, and you would say it was milk of magnesia, what we know as milk of magnesia, spontaneously occurring. We go to another tree, he'd hack something off and he'd show us, and it was what we know as iodine. So all of these are spontaneously occurring in nature and then are commodified by the pharmaceutical companies. And somehow in the mix, we end up being at arm's length from nature and not appreciating our world in the same way.
Exactly. And I think this leads us down wrong roads that increase risk, take us away from the goal of living in a healthy fashion and really accessing our natural potential for healing.
Instead of regarding the body as a car that's sort of breaking down and that's bad, to see that everything that happens with aging has potentially the seed of an adaptive wisdom.
So the body changes as we age, and I think it's important to pay attention to those changes and to adapt behavior to them. A common mistake that I see people make is persisting in patterns of behavior long after they have ceased being age appropriate. So I think being flexible in all aspects of life, in body and mind and behavior, is one of the keys to successful aging.
And our final point here that I'd like to raise has to do with our mothers.
Yes.
Yours is named Jenny. Mine is named Trudy. She passed at the age of 93, mine at 95. Both of them almost identical from your description in your book, full of humor, wit, presence, always asking about whoever they were with, how were you doing, and what about your daughter? Had a genius for making people laugh, always present. I said many things very similar to that in the eulogy I gave for her when she died this past year. And what a wonderful example. And she said to me one thing that when I was very young that I've never forgotten all these decades. She said, Duncan, the most important thing in life is sense of humor.
Well,
and your mother said the
same
thing.
Her words were, no matter what happens to you in life, you should never lose your ability to laugh.
Mm-hmm. And that there's the great adaptability that we've both had as, you know, the great mother. We've had that experience of the archetype, so blessed in our own life with our actual real mothers. And what you say is that our thoughts and how we approach life very much dictates how our life will be experienced in our body. So with our last minute, maybe you could just touch very briefly on that point of how to develop the relaxation and we might say the humorous response in life.
Well, I think it's being aware of the ridiculous side of life, which is always there. I mean, there is a fundamental ridiculousness to life and outlandishness, and I think it's a matter of seeing that and connecting to that part of yourself, and then as you see it, you can relate to that in other people. I think there is no healthier activity than laughing and laughing together. There's even a system now called laughter yoga, developed by a physician in India. And I think it's a terrific idea. It's laughter clubs in which people get together and laugh regularly.
and to not take ourselves so seriously, and yet to take living very seriously in the proper way. And you've got a wonderful story about that, which we don't have time to go into now, as well as a 12-point program for healthy living and aging that is marvelous. And so now that we've suddenly run out of time here, Andy, I just have to encourage people to get your book, Healthy Aging, A Lifelong Guide to Your Physical and Spiritual Well-Being. It's full of the wit and wisdom and presence that we can feel coming through here in this dialogue and that I always feel when we're together. So again, for your life work and for this book, I just want to say, Andy, it's just such a pleasure and a real boon for all of us.
Thanks. Good to talk to you after all this time.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I've been with Andy Weil, author of Healthy Aging, A Lifelong Guide to Your Physical and Spiritual Well-Being. Be with us as we continue next time on Living Dialogues.